It's good to see you all here. This is session number 47, which is number 4 of term 8. Could I ask you a massive favour? Could I ask you just to shut that door so there's no draft and stuff like that? Okay, and what we're going to do today, Be'ezus Hashem, is carry on talking about the concept of prophecy that we've started with, okay? So we're talking about the concept of Nevuah, of prophecy, all right? Let's just get clear what we're on about. I think we got to page 227, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Let's just get super clear as to exactly what's happening. What is the concept of prophecy? So prophecy is as follows. Prophecy is nothing more than a heightened state of consciousness. To get to such a heightened state of consciousness, the practitioner, be it a man or a woman, whoever they are, must train their mind to be absolutely focused so that they can attain that level of consciousness. If they manage to attain it, and there is absolutely no guarantee that the methods that the practitioner would use will result in them getting a prophecy. They can try for years, every day, to try to get prophecy, but unless they actually get there, they may try in vain and all their lives be a failed prophetic candidate. That can happen. If and when they actually attain the level of grand prophecy, which is where their body feels as if it's being turned inside out and their life support system has to be given over to Hashem himself, who has to keep them alive during this heightened state of consciousness, and their mind is literally flooded with this additional quote-unquote metaphorical broadband data that they're suddenly just blasted with, then they will have experienced true grand prophecy and they are given the title prophet. Even if they never ever again prophesy, and even if the moment of getting to that prophecy was extremely fleeting, and even if the data that they were given was rather obscure, unclear, through a series of lenses which happen to be relatively obscured and occluded, they have still hit the grand title of Navi. They've got that. Because their consciousness dipped into that level of reality. How does that work? Bit of a revision point. Holding up the sheet of the four worlds. The human neshama has an element which is at the bottom of the koichus. The yechida, which is the top, the chayin yechida, are actually outcrops of the koichus themselves. Which means the neshama, which we can have access to as a regular daily physical being, has access to these outcrops of the koichus. That's how you can do theurgy. That's how you can do quote-unquote magic with a K. That's how you can do sorcery. You can affect things into the spiritual realm like that. But it's also how your neshama can resonate on a higher enough plane that you can gain access to such data. Is everyone clear so far, or needs to ask something specific on what I have just said? Yeah? Okay. Now, let's talk about the data transmission. What a prophet actually experiences when he or she gets to that level of Nevuah Gedolah, which is grand prophecy, not Nevuah Katana, not Ruach HaKodesh, and not hidden influence. By the way, if you ever experience hidden influence, you may not even know about it. If you experience Ruach HaKodesh, you will certainly know about it. If you experience Nevuah Katana, you will definitely know about it. But in all those things, you don't get the title prophet. You only get the title prophet at Nevuah Gedolah, the grand prophecy that we're talking about. Now, when that data comes through, the data itself for sure is true. The prophet will know this unequivocally and will be absolutely convinced that the transmission was a transmission from the Rabbona Shel Olam, from the Master of the Universe, from God Himself. He'll get that, or she'll get that. There's no doubt about that. But there can be problems. Problems can occur. Let's say that the lenses that that particular prophet has accessed are occluded, or they're the kinds of lenses you get at fairgrounds, which are bendy or wobbly, and they kind of make you look. There's a fantastic another mime there. You can add that to the list. There's a dried cucumber and. Can I say that? Then the data that he or she's going to get through is also bent and wobbly. Not that the data's false, but the refraction or reflection through the Aspaclaria sets that particular prophet has managed to access at that particular time distorts things in such a way. You may say, why is that? That's a very complicated question. Why do some prophets get clearer Aspaclaria lens systems or arrays, really, that are arrays, than others? That's a fantastic question. And then you've got to think about what other prophets there are in the generation. We ended off last time talking about the fact that God utilizes prophetic network hubs. Okay? That's what we talked about last time. Where the arch-prophet of that particular generation actually acts as a transmitter for other prophets in that generation. Which means that the grand prophet of each generation is aware of all the prophecy that's being picked up by the more minor prophets of the same generation. So we explained that Eliyahu HaNavi for sure was aware of Jonah's prophecy to go to Nineveh and tell them to stop being naughty. He was for sure aware of that. We have no doubt about that. We also conjectured that Eliyahu didn't make the same neophyte mistake that Jonah did in misinterpreting the message that God gave him. But Jonah did. That means, had God said, oh, they're all doing tshuva, I'd better send more data through the system to tell them, don't destroy, you know, don't worry, Nineveh's not going to get destroyed. Had that have happened, then Eliyahu would have known about it too, because he was part of the aerial system. He was one of the Aspaclarias. You can have lots of Aspaclarias, a minimum of 9. You can have loads of them. Loads of them. That didn't happen. God didn't send the new data saying, oh, they're all doing tshuva. Send a new thing saying, I'm very happy with you. He actually sent an original message, which in and of itself contained a word with a double meaning that could be interpreted on either way. And that was Nineveh will be overturned. Now, overturned does not mean destroyed. It can include that definition. But it can also include it be changed over. There'll be a turnabout in who they are. They'll be overturned in a wave of religious fanaticism. Which, by the way, the Gentiles who live in Nineveh still commemorate to this day. The Eastern Syriac Church and the Eastern Orthodox churches have the Fast of Ba'utha, which is known as the Fast of Nineveh, which is a 3-day fast of meat, fish, and dairy. Because they believe that Jonah, a Jewish prophet of God, came to their town and saved everybody. It is the most strictly observed fast in the Eastern Christian tradition. Nineveh was, at the time, the world's largest metropolis and was the world's largest city for 50 years until a civil war broke it up. And they today fast on the fast of Nineveh because a Jew came and told us to do tshuva. And they all did tshuva and they all got saved. Now, Jonah was convinced that was not the case. We got saved for Jonah. We read it and we're like, what's going on here? But he himself was like, you're going to die. That's how he was thinking. And then they didn't. And it was all rosy in the end. He was like, hey, mummy, she screamed at God. The third parak, he screams at him. Didn't I tell you this would happen, says Jonah? I can't believe what a mistake you've sent me on there for. Didn't I argue? That's why I ran away from you. Okay, well, Yona, okay, fine. And then God finally addresses Yona, teaches him a lesson, and that's a vital lesson that we all have to have. That's why we got Sefer Yonah, it's a generational message. Any prophecy that's being transmitted, by the way, this is parenthetical, Daniel, Yona, Yoel, we've only got them because it means something to you. The fact that he may have gone to King such and such at such and such an era in such and such an ancient metropolis and is totally irrelevant for you is irrelevant for you. The message as to what they're teaching is relevant for all generations, and that's why you need to hear it. That's why there were 1.2 million prophets, 600,000 men, 600,000 women, but there's only 24 books of the Bible. Okay, and five of them are Moses's. Okay, because we need to hear that prophetic revelation as well. It means something to us. We can learn something from that. They were canonized as part of the written law. That doesn't mean that what they were doing on their day was a message. God had a global message. Yona has a global message for what people should and shouldn't be doing. Everyone has to hear that. Includes everyone that we know about that's in the written law. There were thousands of other prophecies that happened that are irrelevant for us and are lost in the animals in the annals of time. We don't need to know them. That doesn't mean they weren't true. I read once there was an article in the Jewish Chronicle many, many years ago of a Rav that went round and he found a museum with about 50 different Megillus. Not Megillus Esther, Megillus of the same level of miracle, it seems, of Shushan, that happened in Central Europe or in Morocco, where the whole town was going to get killed, and a mace happened, and the whole town was and they wrote to Megillah, just like Megillus Esther, they said, this is such a mace, this is so ridiculously, unbelievably awesome, that we're going to write a Megillah called the Megillah of our town, the Megillah of Akko. And literally the Crusaders came in, and it's unbelievable, we defended ourselves, and Hashem saved us. It was clear that Hashem saved us. Why don't we canonize those Megillahs too? The answer is because we already got Megillus Esther. Yes, these things may have happened. Yes, God may have got involved. Yes, God may, that's great. But that isn't an all-time for every Jew on earth message. It's an outstanding miracle. It's good that you marked it. We definitely accept that there was definite Tzatzit Shema that was going involved. There's definitely the hand of God got involved, whatever it was, but Vakasha, it's not going to become one of the 24 books of the Bible. If it is one of the 24 books of the Bible, there's got a message for you. That's the end of the parentheses. Now we go back to Yona. The Kasha's like this. Look, if you say that, remember, do you remember we did the thing where Dovi was sitting over there and he had a box of tissues? And we had a whole bunch of people that were holding lenses. Do you remember that? And Dovi was over there. He was right in front of the actual divine revelation, which at that particular time was a box of tissues. So Yona gets the divine revelation, and he knows he's got to go to Nineveh, and he's got to tell them to stop being naughty, which is part of the divine revelation. Eliyahu got it, we must assume Elisha got it as well, who was Yona's Rebbe. So everyone knows about it. It's on God's table, as it were, of plans of things to do. Yeah, are you with me? With me so far? Are you comfortable, Dovi, at the back? Are you? Yeah? How then is it possible that he made such a gross error to say, gosh, Nineveh is going to be overturned, and it didn't get overturned? Yona himself, the prophet himself, is a fallible human being. The prophet herself, whoever she is a fallible human being. The data they got's not corrupt. Their grasp of it was not complete. Now, you may turn around and say, well, how on earth can you get to the level of prophet then? I want to tell you something so vital for you to know, so intense, but it comes with a little bit of, it sounds, sorry, like a little bit of criticism of the prophets. And chas v'sholom, I should ever, that's not my intention. But I want to bring it down to brass tacks for us today. If you don't mind, do you mind me going, it's a very important concept for you to understand the concept of what a prophet is and what a prophet isn't, okay? I've already mentioned to you in previous shiurim that a prophet has to go to a prophet school, and we're going to discuss that more thoroughly today. And they have to work hard to meditate. And we did, for anyone that was here last week, talked about the north wind in Ezekiel, and the north wind was the sound of his exhalation. He had to get into a focused trance to such an extent that even the sound of his exhalation was like a tornado or a hurricane, which is too loud for him to hush his mind. That's a concept of Maldim on the north wind of Yechezkel in the first book of Yechezkel. So he's in this trance and That's how focused his mind was. You can imagine all these people in that school, what it would look like if you went to a seminary or an academy of prophecy. Could you imagine walking in there one afternoon while everyone's in like full swing? It would be a weird place. It would not be like this Kylo at, you know, at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Like, there's no Col Tyra there. It's very quiet. And everyone's meditating. What kind of a person would want to check out of a regular life and sit in solitude, meditating all day, hoping for a spiritual revelation? I want you to think about that right now. What kind of a person?
A yogi.
It's one of these people after something spiritual. They're not sitting there screaming, learning over a Gemara, Shulchan Aruch, which is a form of wisdom and a tapped into spirituality, but it's much more concentrated on doing something. They literally want their neshama to resonate with a higher koichas. That's what they want, right? That's what they're after. That's the ultimate accolade. And then they have to sit with their Rebbe, whoever the arch prophet is, who will guide them and say, right, that was nonsense, that was good, work harder on this. So after years of doing this, what kind of person would you expect that person to be? If he's walking down the street, let's say he needed to go to the newsagent one day, pick up, I don't know, a pack of crisps. And you saw him in the street, and you bumped into him. What kind of personality would you expect him to be?
Very, very,
what else? I don't mean disparaging things, but let's be really honest about how we feel about someone that would be doing this with their lives.
Loner.
Right, a bit introverted. Bit into their own spiritual ascension. Now, yes, they're not being selfish, because all Israel, it's a schus for us to have a prophet down the road, right? But to get to that level, you have just got to get into your own world, right? I mean, for a bit, you've literally got to check out. I mean, you probably won't see him at the Apple store checking out the latest iPhones, the latest iPads. Oh yeah, I'm just going to get my latest iOS in, and then tonight I'm going to go do some prophecy, it'll be awesome. It's not that kind of person, right? Because we learned that the prophet literally has to be absolutely right in Midas Tovis. He has to be Marsha Tzadik anyway. He has to be really, really holy and into his Bill Midas and stuff like that. But apart from being that, he's going to be extremely spiritually sensitized. And to do that, he has to kind of like a bit, until he gets rugged in it, until he gets really so good at it that he can just dip in and out of it. He's a master prophet. He's got it. Like Eliyahu Anavi talked to a lot of people. That's fine. But that's because he's holding the level where he can actually dip into prophecy, dip out of prophecy. He's a master. He's like a black belt prophet. You know what I mean? But when you're neophyte and you're still doing your forms and, you know, your kata and your forms and you're doing all your things, you've got to just be so into it to get there. This guy's walking down the road, right? This guy's walking down the road. Would you, anyone on the tape, that guy to run an international mission of diplomacy? Would you pick him? Not a chance. Now let's think of him for a second. Is he the kind of guy that would want to do that? He's thinking all day, my aspiration, one day I will go to Geneva and I will stand in front of the United Nations and tell them they must act on climate change for us and for our children. Is that the kind of person you think about? Is that a prophet? Absolutely no way. He's not that kind of guy. She's not that kind of woman. You aren't going to get to that level of focus where your inhalation and exhalation is like a hurricane because you're so quietly... You just aren't that kind of person. That's nothing against the people that want to go to the UN and work on climate change. That's nothing against people that want to sit in a secluded room, in a darkened room, looking into a mirror, focusing on the letter Aleph and going, which is a prophetic meditation on different vowels of the letter Aleph, as brought in Sefer Yetzirah. Now, if that person gets to the level of prophecy, I personally, and I think you could hear what I'm saying, would not necessarily be thrilled that the message that they're getting is to go to the UN and talk about climate change. Can you think about that for 1 second? They just aren't the candidates. think about this? When you think about this? You got this guy whose mum is prophesying, and finally his mind, he's like, he feels his body like dying, as it were, and his neshama kind of like, and he gets this, and he wakes up, and he's like, right, now I've got to go to Geneva and talk about climate change. Is this the guy that would want to go to Geneva? Is this the guy that you'd want to see in Geneva? Is this the guy that people in Geneva would want to meet? See, he walks in, mummish with a talus and sitsis, and he's clutching, you know, I don't know, some chumashim under his arm. He just walks out to the top of Geneva and goes, I'm here to tell you in the name of God that we have to change climate change. Could you imagine that? Would that be considered a success? It's the last thing he wants. Yonah was a prophet. He was part of the prophecy school of Elisha and Eliyahu. That was the scion of his Rebbes. Great Rebbes. He has a prophetic vision. Baruch Hashem, fire, you know. Oh, I love getting prophecy. It's amazing. This is what I live for. This is what I dream for. This is the moment. You know, like when you're a pilot and you're in pilot school, it's everything's like the sums and the maths and the map reading and this. Finally, you know, you get 1 hour of flight time in a jet solo. Wow, you know, wow. But then you're back on the ground and it's flight crew and it's debrief and it's write-up and it's more lectures and more shiurim or whatever they do. Do you know what I mean? And more weather reports. I want to fly. I didn't join the RAF to do weather reports. I want to get in a plane and go, way! I want to have fun. You know what I mean? This is his moment. And what does he get in that moment? Go to another city in a distant land. It's a long trip. Not the kind of thing you do. And go tell them they're all going to die. Is that still what I'm in this for? I'm not in this for that. I didn't sign up to prophecy school for you to tell me to do this. I signed up for a spiritual revelation. Look, there's 1.2 million prophets, right? And hardly anyone does this. Can't you give me something else? I don't know, show me something beautiful, you know what I mean? Okay, is there nothing else? come on, give me something nice. No, I got a mission for you. Dafka for you, he called him by name, Yonah ben Amittai. You! Go to Nineveh! Me? Could you imagine it coming to me and saying, go to Syria and tell them to stop being so wicked? Could you imagine me doing that? So I now have to go to Syria and just stand in the street. Where does that? In the street. And say, I'm proclaiming the name. Could you imagine that? Would I want to do that? Yonah certainly didn't. And he just said, I'm not doing it. Can't understand, these were people, real people that had tried to get a spirituality. They finally got spirituality, and sometimes that spirituality came at a great cost. That was doing something they had absolutely no desire to do. They were told, go do it. I don't ask you. God didn't say, you know, let's discuss this, you know, I need someone to go to Nineveh. Who's up for it? Any volunteers? There's like, yeah, 50 people at that particular time, probably saying, oh, I'll go. Okay, all right, Smithers. Okay, it wasn't like that. God called out by name Yonah. Now, when Yonah got the prophecy, he didn't get it in a way that he didn't mess up in its interpretation fully. Not that what he said was wrong. He didn't go and say, listen, God has sent me here and I've got to tell you to plant carrots. That would be a misrepresentation of God. That would be a false prophecy, right? Because God never sent him there to teach carrots. You know, carrot planting and stuff like that. That's not what it was about. It was about, he said the right thing. He said all the right things. But he himself didn't get the depth of it. Is that clear? That can happen. Now, that doesn't mean there was a data transmission problem. It means there was a data reception problem.
Interpretation.
Very good, sorry. He received the data as well. You're quite right. Thank you for the correction. It was a data interpretation problem. He got the data. It wasn't as if he received it wrong. It said, you know, Nineveh will be overturned, and he got that. But he didn't fully interpret that correctly. So there was data misinterpretation. Is everyone clear on that? So errors can happen in the system at the prophet end. The receptacle end is a fallible... Just trying to think of a mechanical process. It's an analogy, you probably don't need it. A mechanical process of where something happens And the only real fault that's going to happen is probably at the very end of the mechanical process. The most fallible bit is right at the end. Maybe it's an axe.
When a speaker isn't working properly, and you try and play something.
Right, okay, well, so I'm getting for the tape, I'm getting an example. Maybe a speaker is broken in a radio. The radio's working, it's transmitting, it's sending to the amplifier, the amplifier's sending to the speaker, and the speaker is wobbling in the back, the magnet's going, but the paper cone's broken. So the very last stage of everything is fallible. The paper at the end of the day is probably the most fallible bit in the whole thing, right? So the radio is going to work, but the paper cone is most likely to distort. That's a good, I like that, Nat, thank you. That's a good example. The point is, though, that everything's good up until the end. But I'm going to tell you now that there can be problems higher up in the system. Listen to this. You're going to love this. Is everyone up with me for this? You need to mummish, hold on for this. New data, not previously discussed. Anyone joining this on the tape? You've not heard this previously. This is a new piece of data. It's like this. Imagine I set a test for soldiers who are going to go out to the field to Iraq or Afghanistan, something like that. And I got to know whether or not they're savvy with how to do things. And I say, right, what I want you to do is get to base Charlie Oscar by 3 p.m., 1500 hours today. Yeah? Okay. So they go, okay, fine. You know, they get their backpacks ready and they're told this is the training mission before we go out. We've got to get base Charlie Oscar by 1500 hours. Okay. So they're walking and walking and walking and they're going over, I don't know, the Beacon Breakers or whatever it is, they're, you know, whatever they're doing. The problem is that the field just outside the base of Charlie Oscar, I've mined with live explosives. This is not play mines that, you know, there's a flag that pops up saying bang. Do you know what I mean? Whoops! Smithers has triggered the bang flag. These are real mines! A message comes through while they're all on the hike, warning there's going to be a danger before you get to Charlie Oscar. I'm not telling you what it is, but there's a real danger of live explosives. Now they go there and there's a little sign, you know, with that skull and crossbones saying live minefield. You know that, you ever seen such a thing? Actually, it's a terrifying thing, actually, to see such things. Some places where they do drills and things like that, they tell you no entrance whatsoever, and there's almost a minefield. And edge of Israel, you get some places like that. On the border, there's like a little skull and crossbones saying mines. Terrifying thing. I mean, you're definitely not going to go in there, right? But they've got to go through that field to get to Camp Charlie Oscar. Is everyone comfortable with that? Now, how are they going to do that? Well, they're going to have to kick their training in, right? They're going to have to get out their little knives and their metal detectors and get on their tummies and wiggle forward like snakes, and then kind of stab the ground. And if they hit pick on the end of that knife, then they dig that away real slowly. You know what I mean? Put a flag on top of it, or something like that, or silly string. They actually use silly string and stuff like that. Okay, fine, whatever. Don't worry about that. And then they look. They've got to kind of walk through a real minefield. Someone doesn't care. It's like, oh, I'm going to say Charlie Oscar. Boom, you know. So the cashier is like this. Why would I, as their officer, why would I set them up for a mission to have to walk through a minefield? Could you answer me that question? Why would I do that?
Testing.
I'm testing them for what?
They can get through the field.
They don't get through the field. Whether or not they are actually safe, whether they're actually safe individuals that I can use as a proper soldier. Okay? I need to know that. God has done the same thing. God has set up spiritual minefields specifically to obscure and test prophets. Set it up. To actually destroy their prophetic revelation. So you've got this guy who's sitting there going, ooh, and he finally, he's in the shaman, starts resonating, and he gets in. That's not good enough. God is going to test him with a minefield specifically set up to destroy his experience. Why would he do that? To separate the men from the boys, the women from the girls. Because he's not about to give that data over to anyone that just walks in. Do you remember, for those that were here for the spooky course, the theurgy course, we said there's two types of theurgy, basically. There's type one and type two. One is the utilization of God's names, and one is the utilization of either angelic or demonic names. Remember this? What's the difference between type one and type two? Anyone that was here? Could you help me out? What's the difference between type 1 and type 2?
You need to be a higher level spirituality to access
Excellent. And who can access via type 2, which is either angelic or demonic? Anybody. Anyone can do that. Any Tom, Dick or Harry. Jew, Gentile, Russia, Tzaddik, doesn't matter. God doesn't want anyone accessing prophecy. He is only interested in the type 1 folks. Now, if you are only interested in the type 1 folks, he hasn't even opened a type 2 door. All you've got is type 1 failure. He has literally shut the door to anyone without the password. You know, how can I say? I remember I once went into probably the most secure building I've ever been into. It was in London, and you had to go in. I thought it was only like in the movies or something like that. There really is. I've been into it, where you have to enter a glass box, which is shut on one side before you can go in through a door on the next, and you have to pass through a security quadrant in that box, and a speaker comes on saying state your name and what you're doing here, and you have to show your identification papers to a camera. If they're happy with that, then they open the second door can't open until the first door is shut for our internal latch system. So while you're in that box, you're an absolute prisoner. Now if they're not happy with those papers, they just don't open any doors, they just call the police. Brilliant, right? Very clever system. It's a building in London. Okay, it has something to do with the Jewish community. I'm telling you, it is, but you just have to trust me on that. So I went in there, and it was like, feels like Fort Knox. It's like, but once I was in, everything was cool. But they're like, getting through the security, no one was cool with me at all. Like, I'm a potential terrorist or whatever it is, you know. Like, he's out to kill us. Until we know, everyone's guilty until proven innocent by the security forces. Okay? They're standing there like, I don't care how from you look or who you are, or the fact that your name is on a list and you're meant to be. We don't care. Basically, you're wearing a suicide belt until we know you're not. They were quite, you know, quite firm with me. Once I got in, they were like, yeah, very polite. The same people were very polite with me afterwards. But beforehand, they're like, oh, we will happily shoot you. Happily. You know? There's no type 1, type 2 there. Type 1s can go through one nice door, which is gold-plated, and type 2s is any Tom, Dick or Harry. There's no type 2s. You are only coming in if you're type 1. If you have the credentials, we let you in. If you don't have the credentials, you're in big trouble. You with me on that? Prophecy does not work like theurgy. Prophecy can only be accessed if you have the credentials. Are you with me on this? We've done a lot of preambling scaffolding of these topics. When we read this inside, this should now all kind of just fit in sense. Yeah.
You know, you're saying about prophets are introspective, quiet.
I'm saying the kind of person that would want to enroll in such a life course would originally be like that.
So have all the books of the prophets all about Hashem speaking to the prophets and telling them to warn the Jews because they're doing this wrong and that wrong.
Using them as a goad.
Yeah. Mm. So, why would you choose a group of introspective, non-communicating individuals who can't get a message across because they're always only
excellent question.
Convey important messages.
Wasn't that Moses' own claim?
Yes.
Moses said, listen, you want an orator. Moses said like this, you want an orator and I have a birth or a defect in speech. Right? With respect, you've absolutely picked the wrong guy. With respect to you. I said, look, you know, I'm aware of your problems, but do you think I can't teach you how to speak? Yeah, but I'm the kind of person that has a speech impediment. That comes with a whole psychological thing that I'm used to not speaking out loud. It's not just, by the way, you've got to understand, it's a big picture here. If a guy's got a speech impediment, it doesn't actually just affect his speech. My wife is a speech therapist, okay? And one of the things you need to know about, like if a guy's got, I'm not talking, if anyone in here has a speech impediment, I'm not talking specifically about her. I'm not saying you do, I don't know that you do, but let's say a guy stammers, or a woman stammers, a woman, let's say, that stammers. That woman's self-confidence is going to be knocked. Forget the actual stammer. Forget the stammer. The stammer's almost irrelevant now. She lives with that speech disability. Do you understand me? And that affects who she is. Do you agree that that's a possibility? Do you agree that psychologically, emotionally, it affects you beyond the actual disability of being able to stammer over a particular... Do you understand what I'm saying? Do you remember the cartoon character Porky Pig? Hear the Porky Pig. Do you remember that? That was the first time I've done Porky Pig. there's a lot of stammerers that grew up in a particular generation hate Porky Pig because he's making fun of a stammer, and the kids of that generation would say, here comes Porky Pig. You don't understand the ramifications, the emotional... Marshall Bailey was turning around, as it were. Let's really flesh this out. I just want to say, I have a problem with speech! It isn't, he's just saying, listen, practically, if I'm going to go to Pharaoh's court and I'm going to say per and burr, I'm not going to get the words out, so you're going to be misrepresented. That's not what he's just saying. He's saying, I have a problem with speech. Right? It's way beyond the physical disability. I'm not the right guy. I've been living my life with a problem here, and I'm quite quiet because of it. You don't mean to get... God says to him, I'm aware of that. Get it done. Now, your kasher is, but why pick such a person? The answer is twofold. Very, very important to answer this question. Then we'll carry on, okay? Oh, you want to ask a question? Okay. Of course. Okay. I should always just put a reserve question up, and if you're not interested, just flag it down. I go, wow, no questions. Okay. But let's just talk about this very, very quickly. Number one, it's got nothing to do with who they are, personality types. Their personality type has got them into the level of... Look, remember the Flatlanders? They're living on the Bimmer. They're only 2D. For the guys that don't know the Flatlands, they're only living in 2D, and I want to have a relationship with a 2D creature. So you go, hello, 2Ders. Now, you can't understand, you can't see my face because I'm in 3D. I'm invisible. God has to be invisible to us because he's not in our dimension, etc. Let's say there's 10,000 Flatlanders living on this Bimmer. 10,000 of them. A city full of Flatlanders. They go, hello, Flatlanders. You know, one or two who are spiritually better adjusted or worked on themselves may have felt a force. Probably all of them felt it, but they just got on, you know, but it's just a random freak occurrence that just got on with their lives, right? But two of them out of 10,000 were like, someone's calling me. I feel a calling. Now, they're not bonkers. They don't have personality disorder. They don't have like some kind of mental sickness. They really did hear it. And I really was calling out to them. And out of those two, one of them gets themselves into a trance and says, yes, I'm happy to speak with you, as much as whatever 2D, 3D the interface is, and we talked about all the limitations in that, and that he's only going to get like a barest essential of what I'm talking about, etc., right? He's going to be my liaison officer. He's chosen, forget the fact that he's an introverted person that sits at home, you know, meditating in the evenings. Forget that for a second. Yes, he does that as a hobby. But because he does that, his mind is like, well, I now can communicate with him. Most people are not going to get to live in prophecy because they don't care about it. They don't know what it is. They're not interested in it. They're not going to work towards it. They're not going to develop their personality to be able to be attuned with God. They're just not interested. And even if they knew about it, they was like, oh, that's very interesting, but I have no interest in that because frankly, it doesn't interest me. But the ones who do auto-select themselves, that's why you choose them to a certain extent. Doesn't mean God's like limit. He can pick who he wants, right? I mean, he could technically just cover you in prophecy now and just say, listen, Clive, I need you to do this. He could do that. But generally doesn't do that because you're not into the system. The second point is like this. It's actually good. If you pick an individual who doesn't want to go to the United Nations and talk about climate change and who isn't motivated to do that, their message is much, much purer. Because they're not already built for that. Do you know what I mean? Do you know what I'm saying? Like, you know what I'm saying? Moshe Rabbeinu was the last candidate you could ever think of to speak to Pharaoh, give the Torah over, right? Because he had a speech impediment, he didn't want to be there, he's an ex-convict. I mean, he'd killed an Egyptian, he had a price on his head, he was running away from Pharaoh. He's the wrong guy to choose. The fact that he went back there means, gosh, that's a message from God. It's highly unexpected that he would do that. That actually gives it clarity. You know, there are some Midrashic discussions to say that Esther was hideously ugly. Hideously ugly. And the question is, how can that be? Because we know that she was so beautiful. The answer was to exacerbate the nace, to show up the nace. It's ridiculous. Of all the girls in all of Persia, he chose her. It was clearly a nace. So I'll say she was green skinned. Like, she was really, really a not good looking lady, according to that. So what's, out of all the beautiful women in the world in this Miss World beauty pageant that was going on there under forced labour, I mean, under pain of death, I mean, they had to be there. He picked literally the most, you know, dreary looking woman to heighten the nace. It kind of heightens the nace. He's picking someone who is spiritually elevated. Now, those people may not be the most You understand? Adrian.
Something that really confuses me. You mentioned that Jonah was a stage one prophecy person who was able to
get through the minefield. Yeah.
And you say that to be that, you've got to be a certain level of person to be that.
Mm.
I don't understand why, if he is not of that level of person, why he doesn't go back and remember what happened to Moshe when God called him, and Moshe said, "You don't want me, I don't speak well."
It's like this. It's a totally different, what happened with Moshe was a totally different prophetic experience to what happened with Jonah. And two is, no one's going to get called like Moshe. Moshe was a one-off, as we're going to learn. He couldn't compare himself to Moshe, because it would be completely unfair to do so. We'll learn that. That question is coming from a lack of the data for the next chapter. Once you understand that Moshe was simply and utterly not a comparison for anyone before or anyone afterwards, it's clear that you're not going to turn around and say that. We'll get to that. That's a question. It's a good question, but it needs to be answered with back data. Everyone comfortable now to go into the text with that data that I've given them as a preamble? We're on page 227.7. The shoulder note reads, "A prophet might fail to grasp the complete meaning of his own prophecy, as with Jonah." Yeah? You with me? Point 7. "It is also possible that a truth be revealed to a prophet, and he," the prophet himself who gets this, "not ascertain its full meaning. This, for example, is what happened in the case of Jonah. In his prophecy, he was told in chapter 3, point 4, Nineveh will be overturned. Now, this phrase, however, was subject to two possible interpretations. It could mean the city would be overturned and destroyed because of its inhabitants' sins, which is how he understood it. On the other hand, it could also mean that they would be overturned from evil to good, as God indeed knew would be the case. If the phrase had only included the idea of punishment, then when God changed the decree and annulled the punishment, he would have revealed this fact to some prophet. The fact that a new decree had been issued would have been revealed to the prophets, plural, who were alive at the time." What does that mean, Howard? No? Richard? What does it mean, prophets alive at the time? How does that work?
It means that the transmission will go to the network hub, meaning the prophet of the generation, and then it'll be transmitted to the other prophets.
Excellent, excellent. That's exactly what he's saying here. So we read that again. That fact that a new decree would have been revealed to the prophets who were alive also at the time, as hubs, and especially to Jonah himself. That's because, if you want to write in a little side note, there are connections between prophets alive at a given time. Once you have joined that esteemed club of being on that level of consciousness, other people on that consciousness are connected to you because you're dipping into the same pool. Since God had included both meanings in this phrase, however, it was unnecessary to issue a new decree. God was very, very good with his lashon. He didn't say, right, Nineveh is going to be destroyed. Churban, right? And then they didn't get destroyed. So right, he says, right, Nineveh is going to be saved. And everyone would know Nineveh is going to be saved. He didn't need to do that. Because in the word overturned, it's both meanings. But merely he fulfilled the original decree according to a secondary meaning. Jonah himself, however, did not, underline the words, did not realize that this phrase of overturning had more than one interpretation. And he thought of it only as a prediction of punishment. Our sages say, as the Gemara Sanhedrin, Sadiches on the base, that it was Jonah who didn't comprehend. Not that the data was wrong, but the data interpretation was faulty. And even then, it wasn't as if he completely misinterpreted the data. He told him to stop at red lights and go at green lights, and they said, no, stop at green lights and go red lights. That wouldn't happen. He said the right thing, and one of the interpretations were given over. But in his mind, he didn't think of the alternative type. He didn't think of the other way of saying it. Shoulder note, point eight. Prophecy can be given with or without words. People do not know this. They really don't get this, but it makes absolute sense now that we've talked about it. In the holy language, it could be given in Lashon HaKodesh, varying according to the traits of the prophet. The prophet might just see a tree growing in a field. And two prophets see the same thing, and one prophet sees what? A tree. And the other prophet, Dafka, sees apples growing on a tree. Because what's coming out the lenses, for one, you understand, like we did this thing last time with the lenses, different people see different things. But it's all the same tree. And they'll also, based upon their level of language and their level of erudition and their education, they'll also speak it out in different words. If someone asks them, what do you see? I saw a beautiful tree and it had lovely bark. I go, oh no, some kind of tree somewhere. Do you understand what I'm saying? Point eight. It's necessary to realize there are two distinct aspects of prophecy. Namely, its content and its wording. A prophetic concept may in no way be circumscribed by words. It's an image, it's a concept, it's an idea. The first time we did it with Dov, it was a box of tissues. And in such a case, the prophet will express it any way he or she wishes. Say it however you see it. Some prophets, however, some, not all, perceive a concept that is also circumscribed by words. The way they envisage that is through a text. This is true of the prophecies of Yeshayahu, Yirmiyahu, and other prophets who were specifically given a message for future generations. For advanced students, this is Chaylik on the Rambam. The Rambam says it doesn't work like that, but that's a Machlaikas. But that's the point here. Now, that source is a very interesting source on point 50 if you want to go look at that. But this is the generally accepted opinion. Okay? The generally accepted opinion is that they literally got text. And they were told, literally, you know, like a secretary writes shorthand for her boss or whoever she's taking notes for, or a stenographer, and part of what she's going to do is write text. You with me on that? Yeah?
So are you saying they saw words or they heard words?
It depends on the particular prophecy, but it's certainly circumscribed by the concept of words, right, which they could transmit one way or another. That's not the case in an individual who just sees a tree. And it's, I don't know, burning, but it's fine. Or it's, I don't know, it's growing apples and it's growing dates at the same time. And he's got to interpret that, and then it falls into a bowl or something. And what does that bowl mean? There's imagery and symbolism. Then he's got to write that down. Now he'll tell his Rebbe prophet, this is what I saw. And the prophet will say, right, this was accurate. This is inaccurate. This is flotsam and jetsam. Don't look at the flowers around the tree. It's irrelevant. All that is your mind filling in the gaps. The actual prophecy itself is this part of it. Yeah? In cases such as these, where the actual data is revealed as text, the prophecy was revealed with a precise wording. A precise wording. And these words simultaneously included a large number of concepts.
What does that mean?
It means that Yonah, the concepts with Yonah being overturned, means that either he's going to understand that the city's going to be destroyed, or the city's going to be done in tshuva, etc. There's many concepts in those words. Those words aren't just simple words. They're words from God which may have two or three or four or five different interpretations. Even in such cases where there is words, listen to this. I would use the phraseology, and I'm going to add in a word, intonation, depends upon the particular prophet's own preparation and way of life. Listen to that. Listen to me. Your boss says to you, and you're the secretary, and you're taking notes. He's got like a thing where he says, good day, and I look forward to hearing from you. Now, different people may interpret that differently. The secretary might write, you know, exactly, good day, and I look forward to hearing from you. Others may see that as more scurvy. And others may see that as very, very complimentary. Lahavdil, I'm going off. That's a very quiet one, because I'm not going off that far. At the beginning of one of Beethoven's symphonies, there is a measure which is meant to sound like thunder. It's done with cellos and drums. It's like that kind of sound. Toscanini, who was a very famous conductor, was known as a human metronome. And he read it absolutely as it's written. He didn't take in any of the subtext. Called like this. Bong. Stop. Bong. Stop. Other conductors who were in the room got up and walked out. He's completely missed the point. He's like, I don't care what the point is. That's the text. That's what it says. It's an attitude. Do you understand me? His attitude was, I don't care what Beethoven you say he meant to mean the thunder. All I have in front of me is this chord at this point in time, there in the measure. Bong. Everyone quiet. Bong. Bong. Everyone's watching the conductor. I was like, it's got nothing to do with that. That's how you write the concept of thunder in music. Beethoven would be very upset with you if you did that. He'd want to hear thunder, if he could hear. He'd want to hear thunder. Oh. But he had to write it down in some way. That interpretation is open to the prophet, even where there's text. Even where there's text. Because the intonation, how you read, what is it? I'm going off again. Was it Leo? There was a Trotsky and Lenin. Trotsky was a Yid, and Lenin was a Goy. And I believe that one of the supporters of Lenin stood up in Russia where there was a big argument about communism, and finally Lenin had won, right? And they had a letter from Trotsky. And it was either Lenin himself or one of Lenin's supporters, I don't exactly remember, you can look up the actual story, that stood up in front of everyone and said, oh, we've done it, we're winners, this is us. Listen to this letter from Trotsky. Dear Lenin, you're right, I'm wrong, Trotsky. Pretty good, no? Pretty good. One of the supporters of Trotsky said, give me the letter. Give me the letter. So he looked at the letter and said, I'd like to read this letter. Dear Lenin, you're right. I'm wrong. Trotsky. Same words, no? Same words. But the intonation of those words, the phraseology of those words, is down to the prophet to give over as they understood it from God. Do you understand me? Moses is different. We'll get to that. He didn't put any colour on it at all. Everyone else does, though. We'll talk about Moses, how that's totally different with him. He couldn't do that. He had no ego. He had no way of seeing things himself. He was totally blank. His mind was like literally just woo. He was like a totally clear voice piece for God, as it were. We'll talk about that. In many cases, though, in many cases, this is very important. Now, this ties in with theurgy. Prophets are instructed to perform a certain act in conjunction with their prophecy. The prophet Yirmiyahu was thus instructed dafka to wear a linen belt as a sash. In another instance, he had to place a yoke around his neck. The prophet Yechezkel was similarly told to trace a map of Jerusalem on a brick. Highlight, if you have a highlighter. This is a key point on this page. If you have a highlighter or pencil, or if you're going to make a note. This whole sentence. In cases such as these, the act was used to stimulate the highest forces, you can write in on the side, Koichos, in a manner required by the nature of the particular prophetic concept. And that's why I did 6 weeks of work on the spooky course. Now let me give this to you. A prophecy can come through, and we've said, you know, he's sitting there meditating, and suddenly the prophecy comes in and he's told, do this, this, and this. But then God says, right, I also want you to ring the doorbell at noon. Is that really important? Yeah, it's vital. What, the doorbell? The doorbell, you've got to do it. So the prophet is now under prophetic orders to ring the doorbell at noon. What is going on? What's going on? When God wanted to split the Red Sea, probably the greatest open miracle that's ever happened in history, right? What did he? How did he tell his prophet to go back? What did he say? No, he didn't tell him to lift up his staff. He didn't tell him to do that. Moses did that. What did God tell him to do? He said, lift up your hand. He gave Moses the honour of doing it. Moses said, who am I? I'll give you the honour. The staff has got God's name on. So he lifted his staff. He didn't tell him to lift up his staff. He said, raise your hands. What would happen had he not raised his hand? For goodness sake, he's standing to say. Does it really matter? Raise your leg. I don't know, wave a cap. Do you know what I mean? No, God said, I want this act to do this act. What is going on? Why does the Torah report this? God, this is mummish, a profound secret. Now, this secret we worked for 6 weeks on. What is theurgy? Theurgy is manipulating spiritual forces via ritualistic behaviour. Right, great death. What a great death. Fantastic. I'm going to do something up high by doing something physical on the ground. For instance, if I want to change the way water is blessed on the earth, I wave a luluf, an esrog, in such a way on a particular day. And it has to be those species. Has to be a palm branch. Has to be willows. Has to be myrtles. Has to be a citron. And they have to also conform to all the things in the law which makes them kosher. It's not just any willow. Weeping willow won't do it. It can't be any date palm. It can't be any palm, sorry. Has to be a particular species of palm. Can't be any myrtle. And the myrtles can't have certain berries. It has to be bang on. And if it is like a key in a lock, turns the pins, and then a flow of blessing will come down, which can only come down with that particular mitzvah. Just like mezuzah, just like tefillin, just like any other mitzvah which has a very specific physical outcome. That's why the halacha is so key. Because it has to be a key in a lock. What are these keys open? These gates. The bottom gates in the koichos. When a prophet is given a command, a mini mitzvah, I mean mini because not everyone else has to do it. No one else has to ring the bell at 12 noon. Just Joe Bloggs, the prophet, today at 12 noon has to get it done because that's his prophetic revelation. Say that right? But that's what he has to do. That means it's like a mitzvah. God is telling him the koichos are waiting for you to trigger them at that time. Get it done. Do you hear that? That's what these physical things that you sometimes see prophets have to go and do is doing. Tracing a map of Jerusalem. Why is he going to do it? Yeah, it's got to be a physical ramification. That's how theurgy works. When a witch sits down and does it, she's tapping into the whole thing illegally. But it does work. And if you know what to do, and that's why, by the way, witches, have you noticed? When do witches meet? Oh, midnight, August Eve, midsummer night, the solstice, the equinox. Have you noticed that? Have you noticed they're always into that? Why? Have you ever asked them, well, if you meet them, why are you so makbid on zmanim? Because it's exactly that time that the energy is coming. Who set that up? They don't care. They just know it's accessible. But if they sit and think about it, someone had to make up that system, right? And rig the whole system that at the solstice something happens and at the equinox something else happens. And they're very key to know that equinoxes and solstices. Have you got no? What's an equinox and a solstice? It's the half point and the shortest point. And every single day, a Jew cares about that. Because we have to supplicate the mincha offering by the eve of each day. Can I tell you about the taxi driver who I was with who said, oh, I've been learning about Judaism. You people are all about the sun and the moon. I'll tell you about that. Are you people all about the sun and the moon? I said, are we? I was saying, no, you got a rabbi in the back, right? And he's there telling me, I've figured out Judaism for you. Okay, let's hear it. Always, you know, God can send you all these like, very interesting messages to different people in the world, right? So one of the things that, are you all about the sun and the moon? Dafka, they're right. Look at my luach on my phone. I can't believe I'm going to source my phone. I don't think I've ever done this before in a shit. I always tell people, please get off your phones. It's very annoying. On my phone, look at what happens on my phone. Alos HaShachar, that's the moment that the pillars of light come up in the Eastern Hemisphere at my given location. There's Hanei Tachama, which is where the ball of the sun rises over the eastern horizon. That's the best time to daven the first bracha of Shacharis. Then there's Shema at a certain time. Then they got Chatzosa Yom, midday. Mincha Gadola, Mincha Katana. However many variable hours in, and then they got Plaga Mincha, 10 and 3 quarter variable hours in. Shkia Sechoma, sinking. Sinking of the sun. Capsizing, literally capsizing of the sun. Because I've got to know to put my prayers in by then. And then I've got Seitzu Kachovim, the emergence of the stars, which is the first time that I can supplicate other prayers. All about the sun and the moon. Witches, right? Midsummer's Night Eve. August equinox. Why do you care? Because something is happening at that time. And if you tap into that energy at that time, certain things can be achieved. That was the theurgy aspect. Now I say that God sometimes leaves open doors which are unique for certain people to do at certain times. Say, right, you wear a yoke at that time. Wear, I don't God need you to wear linen. But why not? Okay, look, I don't have any linen. I've got some nylon. Will nylon do it? Nylon won't do it. Because nylon isn't made by retting flax stalks. It's a very interesting point. Tachelis and Asitsis. The actual chemical formula of Tachelis has basically been found. We know that it is what's known as Indian ink or indigo. We know what it is. We know what the chemical is. The Gemara itself says you can get the exact same colour from a root vegetable. Indian ink. But anyone who dyes their sitsis with the vegetable as opposed to the shellfish is a fool. Now hold on. If God wants a particular chemical, like, you know, when I mean chemical, I'm holding up my hands here. Do you know all what I'm holding up? Holding up one of those like chemical signs with C and O and H in all the right places. Do you know what I mean? Sorry, you know what I mean, yeah? That's a chemical, right? And that's what he wants, and that's blue. And he wants the tachelis to be blue, so get your sitsis and dip it in that chemical. What do you care where I get the chemical from? The answer is, if you get it from a vegetable, you're a fool. You get it from the shellfish, you're doing great. You get a mitzvah medaraisa. Why do you, now, I would rather get it from the vegetable because one, it's easy, and two, it's less cruel, right? Because to get a drop of that chemical, you have to kill the shellfish to do it. The Murex truncalis is a hyperbarenchymal. You can't eat it, it's trophy. You kill a Murex truncalis by extracting its hyperbarenchymal extract, which is basically in its nervous system, and that one drop, when fixed, becomes blue. That becomes like Indian ink, that becomes a particular blue. I've got some at home, a thread which is actually dipped in the Murex truncalis. I've got, if you want to see the colour, it's quite a dark, it's kind of, it's not an intense blue. It's quite pale, it's almost like turquoise, like a light turquoise. What do you care whether or not you get that turquoise out of a synthetic source or the actual source? The answer is how you go about it taps into the koichas differently. You got to do it at the right way. God's telling you, listen, this is why I've given you mitzvahs. You tap into the things at the right time, you get it, you don't, you don't. When this physical act was completed, the forces, the higher forces, were readied and designated to translate whatever that concept was into action at the proper time. That's how it works. It's also necessary to realize that the only the one who deserves the actual title of prophet has actually attained full prophecy. If you're some Russia that's, you know, running drugs to kids in Nicaragua or something like that, and everyone knows it and stuff like that, you're not going to get it. But even if you sit there for 15 years meditating, but you're still running the drugs, it's not going to work. You've got to do tshuva. This is an individual who is certain that his prophecy is from God, as discussed earlier. When he reaches this level, there is neither ambiguity nor error in his prophecy. He knows, God told me to ring the doorbell at 12 noon. There's no question, maybe God didn't. Maybe God meant 12 midnight. There's no ambiguity. Yonah wasn't ambiguous that Yonah was going to, sorry, that Nineveh was going to be overturned. He knew Nineveh was going to be overturned. What he was ambiguous on was the full meaning of the word overturned. In a more general sense, however, the title of prophet is also given to one who has the beginnings of a prophetic experience and has attained some degree of revelation in a manner beyond the realm of normal human experience. They're already a burgeoning prophet. Such an individual, however, may not perceive the concept unambiguously and may therefore be misled because they're new to it and what they got was very thin and they might want to flesh out this wonderful experience and they'd be very motivated to flesh it out because think who these people are. They're desperate to have the experience. Do you understand? So if they get the beginnings of the real deal experience, then the scion is to leave it at that and not go, maybe I saw more than I really did. Do you understand? They want this. They want this with all the... They want it so bad. And now they're starting to get it. And they think, what have I got? And then you kind of... It's like an athlete that's training and training and training and training and training and training. And suddenly they make the qualifiers. And when you meet them, they're like... they tell you they've made the qualifier, which is a thing. Right, to make the call. I'm not knocking it. But they make much more out of it than it really is. That can happen. This is what happened in the case of King Ahab's prophets, as will be discussed presently. People who started getting the beginning of something and then were misled. What's this misleading business? We're going to get to that. That's the minds that I talked about earlier. Now, those who know the ways of prophecy fully, which in each school would be the master prophet, the black belt prophets, however, are also completely aware of these stumbling blocks. It's par for the course. Everyone knows it. Like, you know, if you get a top Formula One driver and they're on, they've been doing it for years. We're talking, you know, it isn't as if it's their first race, it's their first Grand Prix, they just got put in on a reserve because some guy got sick. This is what they do for a living. Now, when they go round the Grand Prix, there's only so many racing circuits on Earth. Dubai has its pros and cons. Monaco has its pros and cons. Is it Silverstone or Brands Hatch in England? I don't know which one they use for the actual GP. Do you know? Is it Silverstone? So Silverstone has got, you know, its particular corners, which have to take a set. These guys know the slippery parts of it. Don't go into third when you're throwing at that corner because it won't work. Now, if you actually have a look at racing cars going round the track, they're all following the same line. That's the quickest possible line. And even though the track may be this wide, the actual, you see all the tyre mess coming up, like on one straight. And they're all following the same straight because they've worked out that if you want to shave a tenth of a second off, that's the line to take. That's called the racing line, right? They figure it out. Now, I would have thought I'd drive on the inside. Because on the inside, when you turn right, it's always going to be... No, you want to like swing it around because that's how the cars work. It doesn't work like that, right? They're used to this. But me, on my first go around Brands Hatch, you know, and I'm like, you know, in like a mini or whatever. And I'm like, oh, I think this is really cool. I don't know that throwing it around the corner is ridiculous. You ought to be on the other side of it. Do you understand? These guys know, they know the ins and the outs of this. These experienced prophets teach these things to their disciples. They'll say, just as you're getting this particular kind of spiritual revelation, I guarantee you're going to see your experience X, right? Did you feel like, yeah, I did actually, that's pretty amazing. Okay, I'm telling you now, that X is bad. It is terrible. It's like an itching all over your leg or something like that, whatever it is. This is specifically designed to see whether or not you're going to hold on. Just get through it. I remember when years ago when I first experienced this, etc., I overcame it by this. I started thinking about this and this, and it, you just have to kind of just like phase it out. Oh, wow, because you know, I was really overcome by it. I was thinking, what does it mean? Yeah, don't get focused on it. It's not there to be focused on. It's there to be ignored. One of the important tasks of these master prophets when they are running a school is to bring their disciples to the truth and prevent them from being misled. You're going to get misled. Guaranteed, there's minds in the field. As a teacher for you, I have to teach you that over there, there's a mind. Be very, very careful. This is how to avoid it. Now, errors such as these stem from the corrupting forces that we discussed on pages 83 to 87, which is section 1, chapter 5, point 8, which were put into the Koichas specifically to mislead people. God said he strew minds in the field on purpose. He put evil in the way of prophets who are going to get close to him. Because he wants to separate out people who don't have a Messiah. I'm going off. A Messiah, a transmission, a tradition. Oh,
right.
The Hebrew word for tradition is Messiah. The Aramaic word for Messiah is Gomorrah. Gomorrah means tradition. I'm about to go off. It's a bit political. A little bit controversial. Dump it if you don't like it. But I think you'll like it. How do we know that the reform movement is illegitimate and null in classical Orthodox Judaism's eyes? How do we know that? Not just that. Okay, forget that. They reject, you want to say they reject the fact that the oral Torah was given at Sinai. They go way beyond that. What else did they reject?
The fact that God said the Torah is forever.
They reject the fact that God gave the Torah at Mount Sinai, let alone the oral Torah. Otherwise, they'd only be that bad. They don't believe in the whole Sinai experience. Masorti. Heard of Masorti? Masortis don't believe in the Torah at Sinai either. They don't believe God gave the Torah Mount Sinai. They don't believe it.
So what's their discipline?
But forget what their discipline is. The question is, how could they come to that conclusion? Doesn't the Torah itself say that it was given at Mount Sinai? So how could they, if they've read the Torah, we assume the top people in the Reform or Masorti have actually at least read the Chumash once, right? Don't think you could probably bank on that, but well, let's hope that someone has, right? How could they come to such an erroneous conclusion if the Torah itself says that? This is what I get when I get Jay's Witnesses that come to my door. I love Jay's Witnesses. Jay's Witnesses come to my door. Oh, is it two smartly dressed people? Hello there. Isn't the world in turmoil? Oh, guys, I am so glad to see you two. Oh, man, do I... Mamish Einig. I rip them to bits. Mamish... I don't let them go, because you know they're not allowed to walk away from you. The rules are they can't leave you. They can't run away. That's a rule, which means they're mine. They're mine until I'm finished. It's fantastic. Oh, I can taste it now like a good camembert with a glass of wine. Oh, I love it. I love it. I just go for it. Oh, such fun. Very, very similar to Reform. You know what they've not done? They may have learned some scripture, but they never understood the description of it all. Who cares? They said they're Christian and they want you to think that they really, Christianity is like a form of Jews and therefore we're joining them and it's all, they're just ministering to the Jews. They'll say anything you want to sign you up. They really don't. They say that, but they don't believe it. It's a very interesting concept. But the point is, Reform Judaism's got to reform Judaism because they've read the Torah without understanding it. The truth is, if you'd read the Torah without the Mefarshim explaining it to you, you wouldn't understand it either. And you'd be reformed. But God is keeping you out the loop without Rashi. He doesn't want to reveal it to you like that. He wants you to work for it. The Rabbeinu Bechaya in 1257 said, the Torah is not an automatic inheritance. It's not a Yerusha that just comes to you. Yes, you have access rights to the Torah because you're a Jew and you have obligations to learn it. But don't think you're just going to get it. God has locked the Torah in an encryption policy. And unless you're given the cipher key to unlock its data, you will be kept outside of it. And the only way to gain encryption data is to be linked to the chain of Messiah of tradition from Moshe Rabbeinu. He's given it over to him and all of Klal Yisrael. You are Klal Yisrael. You sitting here are members of Klal Yisrael. The kasher is, will you plug in? If you want to say no, I want to read the Torah myself and make sense of it myself, you are bound to trip up. It is designed to trip you up. There are verses which cannot be taken at face value. And if you took them at face value, you will erroneously conclude the law. In which case, if it's all just a turkey shoot, do what you want, whenever you want. Enter Reform Judaism. We'll take on a cultural feeling. This is extremely important to understand. How can you avoid making these classic errors? You've got to have a Rebbe! Na'aseh lecha Rav! Make for yourselves a Rav! You've got to say, someone who is plugged into the real deal, please will you guide me in the ways of the Torah? And you can't just track, you've got to look into the Torah and say, why does the Torah say this? And he has to be able to say, because we've got this source which indicates that, and that verse comes to state that, according to one of only the 13 hermeneutical principles, which is set down by Rishmael that we read every morning in Davening. Gezer HaShava, Pratu Klal, whatever it's going to be, that's the Rosetta Stone. That is the chum, that's the cipher. And unless you understand it like that, it's trife. Do you understand me? Bring back. A prophet is kept out of the loop by these minds, these negative forces, to ensure that he cannot get in the loop unless he has a Rebbe or she has a Rebbetzin. Everyone needs guidance to tell the part. Anyone that's great in Torah, anyone that's reached any gadlus at all in Torah, has a Rebbe. And they're linked in to a Rav, whoever they are. If a Rav comes to prominence and he writes many great, interesting things, but he himself is not plugged in, it won't last more than a generation. Just fade away. You won't even know his name later. Just a spear. It's not plugged in. That's happened relatively recently in our generations. There have been many people that thinkers that come up, but they've abandoned, they don't have a link to touch. Ostensibly, they seem very orthodox. This is common. Unless you're plugged in and you've got your Rebbes and your Rebbes and his Rebbes and his Rebbes, all the way back to Moshe Rabbeinu, there's nothing to talk about. Because there's no other way. It's locked. Do you understand me? It's locked. You're locked. Are you with me? Is everyone... It's very hot in here, right?
That'll wake you up.
It's pretty cold. It's coming on in. You just took your coat off. You'll be putting it back on in a second. Wake up, guys. God doesn't want just anyone in at the prophetic level. He's not interested in that. When I come down here and I go, hello, Flatlanders, what am I really doing? Think about it. When I say hello, Flatlanders, what am I doing? What am I doing?
I'm trying to communicate.
But who am I communicating? Anyone that will listen. I didn't go to the Flatlanders and do this. Squash, squash. Squash ya. Squash ya. Squash ya. I'll just kill them. I can do that. I'm more powerful than them. I'm trying to come out. I'm trying to reach them. I'm trying to communicate. I'm trying to inspire them. The ones who say, okay, I'm inspired, I got it, will speak to the other ones and go, listen. When you hear that, that's actually the creator, one of them 3D level saying, hello, Flatlanders. I got that. I'm happy with that. When you hear that, that's what that means. And when you hear, I don't know, a horn or something like that from a ship that's got nothing to do with him, that's just a ship that is in, I don't know, but behind his room or something like that, wherever he's sitting. As you go, that's just nothing to do with it. Don't get focused on the foghorn. It's the hello, Flatlanders signal. That's all that counts. This ensures the prophecy we receive is emes. So we get the prophecy, do you understand, for you and me. I need a clear... When you go to see a doctor, you expect them to be trained and knowledgeable. And that's why you have things like the Health Professions Council or whatever, the GMC, that vet doctors to say, this guy really has actually passed his test. He really can do these things to your body. Right? I want that in place for my safety. These forces are allowed to exist and function according to their ordained nature and according to the power they were given. Highlight. One of these powers is the ability to deceive people and influence them in a manner resembling that of genuine prophecy. They're designed to do this. I read a book. There's a... an MI6 defector called Richard Tomlinson. Have you heard of this guy? very interesting man. He's been pursued by the SIS, and life has been made hell. But he talks about the training that he went through to join the SIS, the Secret Intelligence Service of the United Kingdom. And anyway, he finished his training. It's unbelievable. You've got to hear this. You're going to love this. He finished his training, and they had a. There was a party, like a finishing party, where they all basically got a bit drunk. And it was a mixed party. There were quite a lot of ladies there. And there was a bit of fraternising that was going on, but the liquor was flowing and people were talking and... Oh! Anyway, but look, whatever, you know, they work hard, they play hard. The next day, they called everyone in, and Richard was one of these guys that was called in, Richard Thomason, said, you know that girl that you were basically chatting up last night? He said, what? You know you were at that party last night? What party? Yeah, you know there's a party that you went to. That party was actually orchestrated by MI6. To test, there's no such thing as being off duty. You thought you were off duty, but we sent one of our agents, a female agent, to every single guy and a male agent to every single girl to try to extract as much information as we could out of who you are, what you're doing, where you're from. And she managed to get your date of birth, what you're doing, where you're from, the fact that you've been in Portsmouth or whatever, wherever they got there, you know. And she found out about you failed. You failed, man. And that was teaching him never let your guard down. He says on his book. In his book that he wrote, he was sent to, where was that war that was in the, was it Czechoslovakia? No, Bosnia-Herzegovina. Bosnia-Herzegovina, he was sent into war to Bosnia-Herzegovina. He was given a cover story that he was a geologist. He's a geologist and he had to go to Bosnia-Herzegovina. And he was on a train going across Europe. And the most wonderfully attractive lady went to sit next to him and started talking to him about who he was. And he immediately kicked in. Said, this is an agent. And he's got to be very careful. And he kept up the whole geologist thing and that was it. When he finished the thing, he went back and said, by the way, I spotted the agent that you sent to me on the train. And the controller said, no, that was just a missed opportunity. What agent? We never sent anyone. But good training. Good training. Never let your guard down. Do you understand? Telling you this, a very interesting concept. This guy has gone through very, very hard training. He has to be rigorous and not let his guard down for 1 second. Because if he does, he will be misled. He's in a world, like a shadow world, where people mislead each other and lie to each other for a living. Do you understand what I'm saying? He's a liar, and he's dealing with other liars. And he's lying for the Queen, basically. And he's there to get as much data as he can and lie about it and say he's a geologist. Isn't he? He's a spy. Come home and report. And the counterintelligence services, whatever country he's infiltrating, are doing exactly the same thing. And it's a cat and mouse game of lies and deceit, basically, right? That's what he's doing for a living. Okay. A prophet is just the opposite. He wants to get to the ultimate truth. But how do you keep people out of the ultimate truth? You lie to them. That's how you do it. A truth is best hidden in between lies. The word sheker, which means falsehood, is shin kuf resh. Beautiful idea. Kuf and resh are in the right order. It should be kuf resh shin. That's the aleph base, right? Kuf resh shin, 100, 200, 300, right? You just take the shin and put it before the kuf. It's almost true. Kuf resh shin looks like truth. It's just slightly perverted. That's the best way to organize a lie. The best way to lie about something is to tell a half-truth. These forces are designed to work within the concept of truth and then just bend one thing. Unless you're expert, you're definitely going to succumb. Because it's so close to real truth. How would you know? What they reveal, and they do reveal things which is very similar to real prophecy, is not necessarily true. They can reveal false concepts and even bring about miracles to verify what they're saying. The Torah thus openly states with regard to a false prophet, he'll predict a sign or a wonder, and that sign or wonder will come to pass. It's in Parshas Ra'eh, Divine 13:2-3. Amazing. He'll say an eclipse will happen when it can't possibly happen. It's just not going to happen, right? I mean, astronomically, it's impossible, right? And then somebody says, oh, if what I'm saying is true, that really the moon is made of cheese, it's Wensleydale. If there's an eclipse tonight at 3 o'clock in the morning, then I'm vindicated that what I'm saying is true. So everyone stays up till 3 o'clock in the morning. Like, okay. Okay, let's do it then. Bring it on. Right? And I look, and tucking there's an eclipse! And it's in the news, an eclipse, it can't happen, and scientists are brought in, they're scratching their heads. What? It's impossible. We don't know what happened. Maybe another planet got in the way. We couldn't see this. We've been looking at the stars and NASA and everyone missed it. And it got, now, it comes with a catch. Because he says that really the moon's made of cheese. But deep down, that's not true. Why would God allow that to happen? Why would God rig in the system forces to allow that to happen? Why would he do such a thing? Why would God allow that eclipse to occur? And this prophet figured it out because the forces of negativity said, you should know that an eclipse is going to happen out of sync. So he tells everyone an eclipse is going to happen out of sync and the moon is made of cheese. Why would he do that? This is a vital thing you have to understand. Why would he allow that to happen?
So that people who don't have a rebbe can't actually become prophets. You need to have somebody to teach you.
No, but this guy has got it. You're right, he doesn't have a rebbe. But why would God even allow the fact that this prophet could prophesy about a miracle which is going to happen, but it comes with a non-truth? The moon is not made of cheese. I just want to.
But he puts in the Torah that there are false prophets going to come.
What? Excellent. Why? Why pepper the world with jerks?
It's testing us. Do we believe in the Torah?
I can't see it. It justifies all those crisps. Well, a lot of them. You're right. Their brain for obviously is working for him, right? God is testing you by allowing you to see what's going on. He's right. What Adrian's saying is bang on. Right, now think about this. If God's doing this to you, you're just some nice guy, right? You're some guy who, Baruch Hashem, is sitting in a room at night where he could be at home and he's trying to learn some Torah and he's just a nice guy. I'm just a nice guy, okay? That's all I am. Nothing, mate. Just leave me alone, and I'm just trying to be a nice guy. And a guy comes along and throws a false prophet in front of you. Nice guy. I must tell you the moon is made of cheddar. And to prove it, there'll be an eclipse out of sync. Tucker, you wait up. There's an eclipse out of sync. I'd be impressed. I'd pay a tenner to see it. Now the next morning, you are for tumult. You go to Rabbi Gutentag. Rabbi Gutentag, is there anything about the moon being made of cheese? No, there's no moon made of cheese. But Rabbi, there was an eclipse like that, and the prophet said there'd be an eclipse. And yeah, you know what? The moon's, if the Torah says you have to keep Shabbos on a Saturday, and the guy says keep Shabbos on a Thursday, and he manages proves it with an eclipse out of sync, you still have to keep Shabbos on a Saturday. God will set it up like that. God actually says, the reason I'm going to do that is to test you. Now, why would God want to do that? For the same reason I put the mines out in front of those soldiers at the beginning of the session. The truth is, the Torah is all about you. He gave the Torah to Klal Yisrael, right? He gave it to you. He gave it to you to see whether or not you're going to obey it, basically. Whether you're going to live by his wisdom. Whether you're going to do it. It's me talking to the Flatlanders going, hello, Flatlanders. It's all about the people I'm trying to give this experience to. What I've got to do is weed out the flotsam and jets. Look, the first time you go to the Marines or the Air Force, something like that, who's the first person you meet? If you sign up for the military, for patriotic reasons. A sergeant. And what's that sergeant master going to do to you? Make your life a living hell. You have to obey everything he says. Right? Is that true? I mean, have you heard of drill instructors? These people are the scum of the earth, right? They would seem to be like the most terrifying people. I met a guy in Eretz Yisrael who was a Marine, a United States Marine, 2 years active duty, 2 years reserve. And I said to him, are all the rumours about the drill instructors true? He says, not only is it true, you don't know the half of it. He says, they are the worst people on planet Earth. says you have no idea what they do. You have no idea. Until you actually live like that, anything you've seen or heard about is just not the real deal. They are absolutely focused people. Now, really, they're working under orders for the United States government. And what is the order? Anyone who can't deal with what they're going to do, get rid of them. That's what I want, right? I want workable soldiers. A soldier is a person who'll go and kill that person without asking why, without hesitating. I've got to send him to his death to kill someone else for reasons he just doesn't understand. If he's willing to do that, I'm happy to have him, right? Think about it. Isn't that the job? That's the job, right? God wants you to do a job. He wants you to keep Shabbos, he wants you to keep Kashrus, he wants you to keep Tashbach, he wants you to do all these things. It's a job. Who's up for it? Time for a shakedown. Lots of different shakedowns. There could be exiles and persecutions and intellectual questions, and there can be spiritual phenomena. Shake it down. Different generations need different shakedowns. Some generations are very, very strong intellectually, but very weak spiritually. Some are extremely weak spiritually, very strong intellectually. And different groups need different shakedowns. And every shakedown has to be tailored for them so they can justify their position long term in front of God, saying, I deserve to be here. You remember that false prophet? And he was very, very, very convincing. And I was a little bit... I mean, we didn't... Kairach. He wasn't justifying Moses. And he was saying things that were very complicated to argue against. People were like, who should I believe in? That's the test. You've got nothing but the tests you overcome. So God set up in the system an ability for falter to come through for you, for the populace who aren't prophets, to say, listen, you could come to me with prophecy and tell me that the moon's made of green cheese and we should keep Shabbos on Thursday, but I've got a Torah that says that's not the case. So as good as you are and as amazing as magical this is, I'm not playing. Jews are tough customers. Did you know that? We are the toughest customers ever. Don't deal with Jews. You're going to be a prophet, don't deal. Look, Moses. When did Israel believe in Moses?
After the
sea split. When did Moses first reveal himself as the Messiah of that generation? How much long before the sea experience?
When he first came
and said, I'm going to speak to Pharaoh and I'm going to get you out of here. And there was a whole thing where he went to Pharaoh and he said, listen, stop working them. And what did he do? He doubled the workload. You know, the Jews said at that time, if I had a sword in my hand, I'd kill you. That was the Messiah they were speaking to. If I had a sword in my hand, I'd kill you. What are you doing to us? Mordechai was the same. Oh, that frumma. One man won't bow down to that Hitler, Yimach Shemai, and all of us have to die. That manic frumma. So frum he has to be. Look at the situation he's led us into. And now he's a hero. At the time when it happens, people hate the Messiah. How long ago before the sea did that actually happen when he turned up? The plagues lasted all in for a year. They still didn't believe him. When finally the plague started, which was not immediate, by the way. They had a lot of hard time. Finally the plague of blood started. Okay, interesting. Then the frogs. Then the lice. Okay, interesting. Interesting. Did they believe that it was God? No, he's just good for her. We're not sure about this guy. Not sure about him. Even when the sea split, they weren't sure about him. Only when they got to the other side and all the Egyptians were dead, then they believed in Moshe and they believed in Hashem fully. Now they're ready to go to Har Sinai. It took a year. These are Jews. You can't prove anything to them. You can make mixed multitudes and locusts and darkness and fire and ice rain down, and we just don't believe you. We're pre-programmed not to believe. That's why Moses said to God, they're a stiff-necked people. That's a good thing. There's a positive element to that. We are extraordinarily difficult to convince. If a prophet came out today, I'm talking this evening, came out on TV and radio, mass media, social media, and said, right, all Jews have to leave the United States of America immediately, forthwith, get yourself to Israel, get on the plane. I've organized El Al, I've organized all the planes, get yourself to your nearest international airport, finished, we're leaving tonight. You think those planes would be full? Would you?
Seats.
What? Some would go. You're gonna get, yeah, forget it. Just forget it. Imagine this song coming here, you know, just after Marv. Alright, this is it. The redemption has begun. Well done for all your tefillahs. I suggest you sell up very quickly, because in 1 week, could you imagine how people would respond to that air? Could you imagine at this place? Could you imagine? You better be holding, because we are not an easy group to impress. You can have Moses himself splitting the sea of reeds, and us. And as we're walking through, we're going, not bad, not bad. What more do you want? Not bad. Ah, then all the money comes up. All the Egyptians are dead and all their money comes up. Okay. Okay. All right. You're in. Moses, we believe in you. After all that we've seen, that's enough. Do you imagine that? So prophecy can come up and try to hoodwink us into keeping Shabbos on Thursday, but we're not an easy, but we're stiff-necked people. And we inherited that stiff-neckedness from our forefathers, our ancestors from Egypt. It's a good thing, because people have come up and changed Judaism. Jews have acted as prophets and made miracles happening, saying that Judaism is no longer the same Judaism. Okay, that has happened, right? We are all aware that that has happened. What are you going to do? You're going to believe in that? What does the Torah say? That's when the Jehovah's Witnesses come to the door. And I say, do you keep the mitzvahs? No. Why not? Because the Torah's been superseded by the Gospels. So I said, but there's a problem. In Parsha Shoftim, in Devarim, it says you cannot add to or detract from the Torah at all, Baal Tosef.
As Jesus said as well.
Jesus says, I'm not going to change it a jot or tittle. But yeah. Paul said, do what you want. Yeah. And Martin Luther said, all you have to do is accept Yoshkin, your heart, and you're set. The Torah, how do you answer that? The Torah says you can't do that. Someone's going to come up and change it. You can't change it. Prophets will come up. Real prophecy will happen. But it will come from these negative forces. This can happen to a person against his will. And it can be brought about intentionally. This can happen to a prophet who did not in any way want to get such a negative prophecy. But he was rubbish. He was trying, and he wasn't careful, and he didn't listen to his Rebbe, and he went down the negative path of all these minds, and he got completely misled, and he runs out of the school going, I've had a vision! The Rebbe's like, oh no! He didn't have a texting to send like an emergency text through the web to say, you know, don't listen to this guy, he's wild, you know what I mean? There was no texting in those days where he could quickly email someone. Or it could happen that he was out to get a negative vision from the outset. So you've got two issues. One is we could get a guy that just makes a mistake and is overcome by the prophetic spiritual experience. And one is an out-and-out charlatan that, for reasons of being able to charge a lot of money, will go knocking on doors saying, I've got a prophetic revelation for you. Very good. Well, we'll talk about that. What we've got to understand is how this works. What's happening in both of these cases is the spiritual forces of negativity, which are placed in front of a prophet on purpose, for whatever reason, trip this guy up. Either he's inexperienced, uncareful, unlearned, unable, delete as appropriate, or he is out knowingly to get, he's not interested in true prophecy, he's interested in something that will give him honour, prestige, rank, income, whatever. And he'll get that because the Sati rates that at that particular time and generation. And, you know, they'll think highly of me and I'm a bit of a nudnik, and now they'll think I'm a good guy. And what do I care if it's real or not? I want the physical benefits of being given this status. Everyone walks in, stands up for me, they think I'm a real big shot. Really, I know it's a joke. That's a charlatan. The other guy really believes he's genuinely received a mystic prophecy. But he hasn't. He's been misled by the Kochos. By the Kochos of Tumah. He's been misled. That was set up there. And his Rebbe's mamish platzing. And what are we going to do? And writing letters. Don't believe this guy. But in the meantime, he whips up a religious fervor around himself. how that works and scriptural analysis of both examples is up for next time. I look forward to continuing with you then. Have a fantastic week.